You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, September 28th, 2016, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
So, guys, I have solar panels on my roof now.
What?
When did you do
that? Awesome. How did that happen?
Was it a surprise?
I don't know. These people just showed up and started putting them up there.
were they elves?
No, I've been working on this for months. It takes a long time. It's a whole process. But now I'm going through a company that, you know, they put the panels up and they own the panels. And then they sell you the electricity cheaper than what you get it from your regular provider.
Uh-huh.
So I don't do anything. I just get cheaper electricity.
What the hell?
Yeah.
That sounds too good to be true.
So, Steve, how do they make your roof not leak? Did you talk to them about that?
Yeah.
What do you mean? My roof doesn't leak?
No, I mean,
not yet.
They have to attach the structure, right? There's some type of armature that they put on
your
roof.
That's right. Correct.
Okay, so now I'll restate my original question.
How does that not make the roof leak?
Yeah, how do those holes that they drill in your roof not leak? What do they do?
Well, I'm sure they tar them back up. I mean,
yeah, just seal them
up. I do remember when we re-roofed when we first bought the house, they were like, if you want to do solar, it's better to do it now while the shingles are off, because they have to like mess up your shingles and then kind of patch all of those spots when they put on solar panels.
But it didn't seem like, I watched the whole process. It didn't seem like they screwed up my shingles at all.
Oh, that's good.
So I learned a couple of things. There's a lot of wrinkles to getting solar on your roof. But the good thing is, like, this company, since they're, I guess, somehow they're making money off the whole thing, but because I guess they're going to be selling me the electricity from the solar panels, they do everything and they pay for everything. So literally, it's not a dime out of my pocket up front, which is very nice.
That's good.
That's really nice. Yeah, because it's the startup fees that make it so that it's impractical for a lot of people.
Yeah, and I think if you have the cash, if you're sitting on the cash, it probably, and you're going to own your house for 20 years and you have whatever, there's a lot of variables, mm-hmm. It might make financial sense to buy it outright. And leasing is a little problematic. I mean, leasing may work as well, but as long as it's like leasing a car, as long as you got a good deal and you're leasing to own or whatever, but you can get screwed with leasing. And these kind of deals, you got to make sure you're dealing with a good company too, because they could screw you as well. They could sell it to you cheap and then jack up the prices over time. So you have to make sure that you're locking in low prices over at least 20 years. Mm. What's also interesting is that they have to check with the local electric company, which in our case is UI, United Illuminating, to see if the local transformer, whatever transformer is serving your house, has the capacity to take the electricity from the solar panels.
I see.
Yeah.
And we were right on the edge. In fact, at first UI said, nope, you don't have enough capacity. And then they said, no, I guess you do. They reevaluate, whatever. I don't know why they changed their mind. If you don't have enough capacity, you have to then pay for a transformer upgrade, which could be $5,000 to $10,000.
You can't just buy a battery. You know, those like whole home batteries that people are starting to do. God, I want one of those.
You mean to store the excess?
Yeah, you just store all the electricity straight into your own battery, and then you feed your house out of that rechargeable battery.
Yeah, but the thing with solar is you got to put it in the grid. It's not like when the zombie apocalypse hits, Steve hits a switch and the solar goes to his house. It would require
to put it in the grid. You can put it into a battery with high capacitative storage.
Yeah, but Kara, once the battery's full, then that electricity has to go to the grid. So no matter how you slice it, you have to be rated so that the maximum peak output of those solar panels can go right to the grid.
Buy a second
battery. Your local transformer has to
buy a second battery.
has to be able to handle it. They won't let you put it up there unless it has the capacity to handle that voltage.
Well, you don't want to shut down electricity to your whole city. That would be bad.
What that means is that, like, if you and four or five of your neighbors are going to one transformer, only one of you is getting solar panels on the roof.
Well, that's if you live in a small place where your transformers aren't big. I think in LA, if five of my neighbors had solar panels, we'd be okay. I think
that's not true, because the transformers are already allocated to their use. You know what I mean? It's like you have just enough transformers to get the electricity to however many houses or units it's going to.
So they didn't anticipate people doing this and being ready to sell
that. Yeah, but there are whole neighborhoods down the street from me where every house in like a 2-block radius has. So they must have upgraded.
Maybe they upgraded.
They paid for upgrades, right. So like the first person in is good. You know what I mean? But if the second person, maybe, then it's close to like, but third person.
Sounds like a pyramid scheme.
Yeah. But beyond that, either you're screwed or you're paying for an upgrade, you know.
There you go.
In order to handle it. What I think the states should just mandate that the electricity company just pays for the upgrade. But of course, they would
ultimately charge it back to the customer.
Yeah, sure. So. It would diffuse the cost. But I mean, you know, that's just one way. If you're trying to encourage people to put solar panels on their house right now, you know, and the companies that are doing it for profit, like the company that I'm going with, they evaluate your house and decide if it's worth it to them to put solar panels on your house. So they, you know, evaluate how much light is hitting your roof, how much would it cost, you know, how many panels it's worth putting up there. And then they also assess the infrastructure cost. So if they have to pay $5,000 to put a transformer up, they'll say no, they won't do it. Yeah. So getting in early actually there's an advantage, you know, to being like the first in your neighborhood to go solar, I guess.
Steve, did you think that you were going to have access to that power yourself?
No, I knew it goes to the grid. But I won't be able to use these things for a couple of months because they have to, all the inspections have to take place. But also, the company needs to install a two-way meter. Right now, there's only the electricity is being metered coming to my house, but they need to meter it going out of the house as well. So that's another sort of state regulation, right? Like the state has to require that they meter electricity, you know, going to and from the home if you put up solar panels so that you get money. So they have to pay me for whatever electricity I put into the grid.
Oh, you should see, too, if they offer a time of use meter, because if there are ever times when you're actually having to pay for electricity because you're not giving enough back to the grid. At least here in LA, they have incentives, you know, because people drive electric cars and things like that, where if you use most of your electricity during off hours, if you have a time of use added to your meter, you'll get a discount on that electricity. So like anybody listening, you should check and see if you have that option to upgrade your meter to a time of use meter, because it's it helps, right? It helps with the energy crisis, especially with brownouts in the bigger cities, and it can also make sure your electric bill's a little cheaper.
Well, that's awesome, Steve. Let me know how it plays out. You know, I'm really interested.
I figured it was time. I'm, you know, as you know, we're always following the tech news. Like even today, just today, I'm looking at news. Oh, a new breakthrough on perovskite solar panel is going to dramatically increase, you know, the efficiency. But what's actually happening is that the efficiency of solar panels is going up pretty steadily, about 2% per year. So there's no point in waiting. Not going to be any dramatic, I don't think, change, at least nothing that is on the horizon. And I figure if you do it now, it'll help. Because, you know, and everyone can't wait for it to cross some imaginary optimal line of efficiency. The industry would never be able to get there, would never be able to take off. So anyway, whatever.
Well, is it going to slow down, you think? I mean, that 2% is actually not insignificant at all.
No, it builds up over time. I don't know. Who knows, Jay?
Sure. 50 years, 100%.
But Steve, yeah, we've crossed that line where it's actually, there's, you know, for depending on what state you're in, et cetera, that for a lot of people, there's no reason not to do this. You know, it's just use your roof, put up solar panels, you get cheaper electricity, and you're generating greenhouse gas-free electricity.
The idea that all this solar radiation is leaving the sun, this little, tiny little patch of solar radiation is hitting the roof at Steve's house. Now imagine how many roofs of Steve's house there is out there that we're not collecting.
Yeah.
Most of them.
99.999%.
But the point is, like, there is a significant amount of solar radiation hitting our planet that we can catch. Significant, like a huge amount of power hitting our planet. And so much of it, the vast majority of the energy, is just going into outer space with no way for us to collect it yet. You know, but it wouldn't be amazing if we were like, hey, we have solar array things that are all over the place, you know, maybe in the same orbit as Earth, or I don't know. I don't even know if that's even possible, but collecting a ton of solar radiation.
Oh, yeah.
So get this, guys. Absolutely. Let me see. What is your guess? So I use – my house uses a lot of electricity, tons of electronic devices, electrical air conditioning. So throughout the year, though it's a lot more in the summer, but even throughout the year, I use a lot of juice. What percentage of my electrical use do you think will be covered by the electrical generation of the solar panels on the roof of my house?
25%.
I think it'll be high. I think you might get close to it depending on time of year. You mean over the course
over
of the
whole
year?
Course of the year.
Mm, you're in Connecticut.
Mm. Yeah.
And I don't remember. Your roof was pretty clear. You were like in a cul-de-sac.
Totally clear roof.
15%.
I know. I think it'll be more like 70%. I think it'll be high.
No, yeah, wait. You want to know what percentage of your total electrical use you're going to be collecting?
Yes.
And giving back to the power
company. 15. I'll say 10%.
Wow.
100%.
Yes. I knew it. I knew it. 100%.
Because they looked at my electricity bill from the entire year before. They could see exactly how much electricity I used. They calculated from the sun exposure and the number of panels. They're putting enough panels on my roof to cover 100% of my electricity use.
Which so means you may come out in the black.
On average,
over the course of a year. Yeah, you average
out.
You
might end up making money sometimes.
Well, I don't make it. They make it because they own it.
Right.
But here's the other thing. The solar panels they put on my roof, if I bought them outright, would cost $90,000.
Yeah.
Although with rebates, you get a lot of that back from the state. It would be
wow,
like 60.
That's how expensive
but it,
they
are. Yeah. Would have been like 60 grand out of pocket if I just bought them outright. So which
well,
I don't,
especially because he's got enough to cover 100% of his
that's,
usage.
Yeah, that's it. It's a big
that's
install.
Why, yeah.
It just so happens that my roof is arranged so that both sides are worth putting solar panels on. But like
whoa.
If my house were facing south, for example, they would only put them on half of the roof, you know, only the south facing half. But mine is like right in the middle so that both sides will get enough light to make it worthwhile to put solar panels on. So my whole roof is going to be covered with solar panels. That's why it's going to cover 100% of my electricity. But that's interesting.
Oh, man, I got to do this.
It's interesting.
I'm so jealous.
100%.
Yeah, 100%.
I was going to say that if you bought them outright, you would disconnect from the grid, but that doesn't account for
– No, you wouldn't. You would not be able to do it. You still would be selling it back to the company, you know, putting it to the grid and taking it from the grid because it's not going to –
But you would bank the money.
Well, yeah, but then you have to calculate how many years would it take to pay off the solar panels?
20 to 30 years.
It could take 20 years, yeah. So it's – yeah, again, it probably is not dramatically different when you – calculate it out, but there are some scenarios where it might be advantageous to buy it and others where it isn't. It's just not a good financial idea to buy it. You're better off
that's right
just getting the cheaper electricity and not the other thing is they'll maintain it. I don't have to do anything. It's totally on them. They own it. They're just basically using the roof of my house and selling me the electricity.
You definitely want to look at like where you live and what kind of incentives are available to you because you've got federal, state, and oftentimes city, depending on where you are. So definitely like you want to research all of that.
Exactly.
Oh,
interesting.
I want to do it.
Yeah.
I'm going to do it.
Yeah, yeah. It feels good to know that like all my electricity is going to be generated through solar energy.
Very
sweet.
Cool.
Steve, if you plug that into your house, got off the grid, I wonder how many more solar panels you would need to cover you for the entire year in any situation.
Well, you just need backup power.
I need a lot of batteries. Yeah.
Yeah, you need a lot of batteries. Because obviously you're at 100%. So if you had a lot of batteries, you'd be okay.
But I bet you. Like, I'm at a top of a hill. I have a lot of wind, especially during the times of year when I don't have a lot of sun. I bet you if I had one windmill, I could be almost all and batteries. I could probably be off the grid. They have these windmills that are like they're tubes.
Little ones.
Yeah, that you could put them on the apex of the roof of your house, and it's like a tube, so there aren't these free swinging blades. And so, yeah, it's something like that. I mean, so if you combine solar panels and then put a couple of those portable little windmills on top of your house, especially if you get wind, you could. Yeah, that's a lot of renewables.
Geothermal too.
You know,
a little geothermal.
What do you think the future holds, though? Do you think that neighborhoods or towns will all have like their own solar array? Like, think about this: 20 years from now, we might have a couple of breakthroughs or whatever. But you know, solar panels are going to be 40% more efficient if the curve is consistent, or even more. You never know. That's really a lot of electricity that you can.
I think it'll be mandated in certain areas. I mean, in Los Angeles, for example, you can't put a new roof on your house unless it's a certified cool roof, meaning that it has to be white or light gray. Mm-hmm. Nobody, unless you're grandfathered, you cannot put a dark roof on your house anymore.
Wow.
Like screw style, it's you need a light roof. So I think we're going to see in some of the cities that are more, I think, progressively minded, that there will be mandated clean energy initiatives for the citizens.
Right. But that only makes sense in a very warm climate because in Connecticut – that would be great in the summer, but in the winter you want a black roof, you know?
No, it'd be bad for you. Yeah, but in LA it's a horrible idea to ever have a dark roof on your house. Like year round. Yeah.
Good question. What happens with snow buildup on the panels?
Do they have little wipers?
They have a robot that they have in a little hut on the roof.
That's a good question.
I think they're heated.
Oh, so derp. They're heated.
I would hope they're heated.
That makes perfect sense. You know what I want? I want in my backyard a nuclear reactor, a fission or fusion reactor buried in the ground. And I'd be good for 50 years. Yep. 50
Full
years.
On Mark Watney.
Done.
And Bob, it would only have to be about the size of a lunchbox or something. Yeah. Wouldn't be that big.
It'd be for one house.
No, it's the size of like an outhouse.
Can you imagine that?
Yeah,
that
would be they have a reactor. You could buy
it. But you can't get it smaller?
No, it has to, because it's, you know, it's a self-functioning nuclear reactor, man.
The one in the Martian was like the size of a big cooler.
Yeah, it fit inside the...
It wasn't that small, or it wasn't that big.
That was different. That was using the, you know, the decay.
Yeah, that's just radioactive
nuclear decay.
Wasn't that a waste product in the movie?
It was a waste product. That's true. They buried it with a skull and crossbones, so you don't.
It wasn't that dangerous. That was one of the scientific mistakes.
You're right. Yeah, they never would have worried about burying it. That's true. Dang
All
it.
Right. Well, let's go right. on. Carol, we're going to start with a what's the word this week.
Awesome. So the word this week was suggested by a listener named Steel. What a cool name. His first name is Steel.
Blue
from
Steel?
Indiana. I know, right? So Steel, thank you for sending this in. And the word is apophenia. Have you guys referenced this word a lot in the show before I joined?
Not a lot.
Apophenia?
A few times.
We have mentioned it, yeah.
It's a good one. So according to the Merriam-Webster Medical Dictionary, apophenia is the tendency to perceive a connection or meaningful pattern between unrelated or random things, such as objects or ideas. And they cited an August 30th, 2004 reference from the Post and Courier in Charleston, South Carolina, as a good usage. The promise of the data age is that the truth really is in there somewhere, but our age has a curse too. Apophenia, the tendency to see patterns that may or may not exist. It's not quite synonymous with pareidolia, which is actually kind of a type of apophenia.
Right.
That one specifically refers to finding patterns in visual data, like seeing faces where there are none.
It's more sensory data, Kara. So pareidolia,
sensory data, that's true. Not
because it could
visual.
Be visual or it could be
or
hearing.
Sound.
Could be sound. Whereas apophenia could be just ideas. You know, it's not just sensory data. Yeah.
That's true. In pareidolia, you might hear a sound or, you know, like we've talked about a lot, like the phantom ringtone. If you hear something that sort of relates to that, or you might hear your name in the noise of a crowded room or something like that. But with apophenia, definitely ideas are often connected. And further definitions in other dictionaries actually clarify that it could be a normal phenomenon of everyday life. A lot of people experience it, or it can refer to a clinical symptom, such as in schizophrenia, when apparent connections and patterns may feel oppressive or ominous and kind of persecutory. So that sort of lends itself to the etymology. It was first coined in German, its German form, from psychiatrist Klaus Conrad in 1958. He was describing the onset of a psychotic episode in patients with schizophrenia. The roots of the term are apo, meaning away, and phainin, meaning to show. Those are both Greek roots. So think of it this way. An apophany is in contrast to an epiphany.
Whoa.
Because the latter, the latter is rooted in reality. You have an epiphany when two things connect meaningfully and you're like, oh my God, I get it. Whereas an apophany is not rooted in reality. It's when two things seem to connect, but they don't. Apophenia.
Oh, I love that word.
Right?
It's so good. I got to use it.
More often.
So good.
Yeah, it's a cool word.
Yeah. Good for the skeptic toolkit, for sure.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. Put that one in your toolkit. All right, Jay, you got a couple of NASA news or space exploration news items you're going to talk about.
So, yeah, so Tuesday, September 20th, 2016, that was last week as we record this, NASA made an announcement that they made some incredible findings. They always like to tantalize us before they tell us what the thing is.
Why do they do that? We're going to announce something really cool in 2 days. And then why don't just announce it? Just come out.
No, it's fun. It gets people speculating on what it is, and it's a little intrigue.
Yeah, you got to hype space. That's
but it sets you up for disappointment because usually you're thinking something, you know, much more interesting than what happens.
Yeah, but you are not a typical consumer of this kind of news. Think about the kind of quote-unquote John Q. public. Like, let's get us excited so that It actually registered.
I think the public goes even crazier. I think they're thinking aliens, whatever. They're just they're, we know it's going to be like, yeah.
Yeah, because yeah, you know, then right. when they announce whatever they have to announce, we're like, oh, all right, whatever.
Yeah. It's not life. All right, whatever.
It's,
a, yeah.
it's not Close Encounters. The ships aren't haven't landed.
So I think they did say that they took imagery of Europa or something to do with Europa, but they made us wait until the 26th, which was 2 days ago as we record this, to find out what it was. The latest mission to observe Europa had a finding that surprised most people. There was evidence that plumes of saline water were shooting from Europa's surface, which I think is wow. freaking awesome. And if these findings are actually true, then the ocean that's beneath the surface, which you really can't see it, of course, from the images, it's more reachable. It's more reachable than NASA Absolutely. Originally thought, which I think is really cool. So using Hubble's ability to see in the ultraviolet spectrum, they over a 15-month period, as they were observing Europa, they observed it 10 different times, and three of those times, water eruptions were seen coming from the surface. The water is either coming from the ocean or from an alien base, you know, deep below the surface, but it's most likely coming from the ocean. Now, these plumes of water reach about 200 kilometers or 125 miles from the surface. 125 no. miles of shooting water.
That is wow. insane.
It's insane.
And the then pressure the water, is incredible.
Yeah, water but, the, comes, but keep in mind, Europa low gravity, doesn't have that much low gravity. Yeah, it's low gravity.
Oh. So.
That's still so crazy. It, whatever. It's like the biggest geyser ever.
You could spit 120 miles on Europa.
That's so cool.
But the water
some moon back down on Europa. Jump in the air and go into orbit.
You could ride that. That'd be a fun ride. Maybe imagine we finally get like a theme park out on Europa and they put like a water ride. You ride the plume, yeah, you know?
Don't lose your tether.
So cold.
Yeah.
And you're bombarded with radiation.
Yes, I hope you have a good radiation suit.
Good wetsuit, radiation suit.
Exactly. All right, so the water comes back down.
The water, yes.
And it rains probably down. In the form of ice crystals and other squid-like aliens that get shot out from that I can't help
that
myself.
Video game.
So, yeah. The team who found the plumes were looking at Europa when it was in its transit of Jupiter. Steve, that means it's passing in front of, okay, in case you didn't know.
It would be hard to see it when it's behind Jupiter.
Exactly. So Europa passes in front of Jupiter, and then they were able to, for some reason, when it's in the transit, they could see things better. These findings are important for a couple of reasons. First, they lead us to believe that there is warm saline water below Europa's surface. Guys, this screams potential life. I mean, sure. I'm like scared and excited at the same time. I think
gotta
it's
have,
awesome.
Yep, water.
And warm water. I mean, gee, man, if there's bacteria in that water, could you imagine, guys, like real bacteria? Like, all right, you know, then you got to start doing all, what kind of bacteria is it? Does it have DNA? Is there any of that bacteria found on Earth in any, you know, like, oh my God, forget about it.
It's amazing. A scientific discovery of ever, if we yep. find life oh, off gosh. The Earth. Whatever. The obvious thing here, we have to send a probe to Europa and
oh,
check
absolutely.
It out.
Oh, okay.
That's yep. what this is setting up. Yes.
That makes
a
me think
specific
of
mission.
Two things. Well, one thing, really. I know some people at NASA who are specifically on the Europa mission because that's out of JPL, which is very close to my house. And without naming any names, I can
I
tell you that
you.
They have wanted to do a probe mission for ages. I don't think NASA's interested in a probe. NASA's really but pushing for an orbiter.
We have a mission that's on the table to happen sometime in the 2020s.
Probe?
A
orbiter.
No, an orbiter, not a probe.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. They specifically have poo-pooed the idea of a probe, but I think what's really cool is that these geysers...
Don't poo-poo the probe.
I know, they poo-pooed the probe. I don't know why. And so there are a lot of people pushing real hard for the probe. The higher-ups don't want the probe. They want the orbiter, which I guess is kind of an incremental approach.
You would kind of need both, I would
what
think.
What if you right. flew into the geyser? What if yes. the orbiter got that low?
Kara, exactly. Now that we know that there's apparently these holes that go down to the ocean. Guys, you know how far down it is? You know,
far. 10 feet.
That some of the, a lot of the ice is considered to be warmer ice, so it's not as hard to drill through. But it's up to 100 kilometers or 60 miles worth of ice.
It's insane. It's insane.
Yeah,
it's a
lot. Yeah, wow. So, but if there's cracks big enough, you know, I mean, if the water's coming up from somewhere,
yeah, if the water's coming up, that makes sense. I mean, I'll tell you, I visited a lab where they're working on prototypes of drills to dig into the ice, and we weren't allowed to air the footage because NASA's like, this is never going to happen.
But I did think of something, Kara.
Yes.
I think we should invent the phaser. right? We invent the phaser first, listen. Very important. If we invent the phaser, then we can put a phaser on a probe that has a robot arm. It could shoot the ice and melt a hole right down to the ocean, and then we're good to go, and then we get phasers.
Or we could just orbit and collect a sample while we're in orbit.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, if you don't want to
be cool, why go simple when you can be overly complex?
Fine.
You know, once they confirm, if they confirm those geysers, that should be our number one, you know, orbiter priority above Mars.
Oh, completely.
Anything
else?
For
our planetary space mission, sure.
Well, they've got to rethink the science that they're putting into the Europa mission right now.
What do you guys think of the chances are that there is a creature on that planet?
I think they're going to be
a living molecule.
Define a creature.
Something bigger than bacteria, like a crawling thing.
I think it's going to be bacterial, or maybe like protozoan, like somewhere in that realm. I think it's still going to be unicellular.
Still microscopic.
I think it will clearly be chemosynthetic.
How about a water puppy or whatever they're called? A water puppy.
Oh,
water bear?
Bugbear?
Moss.
What do you think about
those? Moss piglet.
Yeah.
Moss piglet.
Yeah, there might be some moss piglets there. Well, those are, how many cells do they have?
That would be amazing.
The unicellular.
That's pretty, that's pretty advanced.
They're mouth parts and stuff.
Big time multicellular.
That's pretty advanced.
Yeah, that's true. But they're small. I don't know. Like, I don't know. I'm wondering. Mm-hmm. If this is really new is this really new information? I mean, I know it's new information because we have direct observation, but don't most Europa researchers already know that there were like geysers?
I think this is the first evidence of it. I mean,
it's the first direct evidence.
Okay.
Other moons have geysers, but
Enceladus,
I'm not aware of any on
Europa. Enceladus has a geyser. Yeah,
gotcha, gotcha. So this is the first direct kind of measured evidence, but it's not yet confirmed.
Right. It's not 100% with the data that they have. They want to take a look at it with infrared observers. I think when the James Webb telescope goes up, that could do some confirming observations. But these observations were with the Hubble.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, Hubble.
Still doing,
I'll tell you what.
Still doing good science. Powerful. Yeah.
I'll tell you, well, gosh, how important has that instrument been in our
science? Oh, I know, right? It doesn't quit. It's still kicking
outrageous.
Ass.
So you guys remember the solar freaking highways or roadways?
Oh, yeah.
Of course.
Oh, gosh.
How
don't
could
get
I forget?
Me started.
Because
don't get me
Thunderfoot
started.
Lumped me into a solar roadway rant when I did a story for a local news show here about something completely separate.
Yeah.
So anytime anybody brings up solar roadways, I get like Google hits on it. It's so annoying.
Well, have you heard of piezoelectric freaking roadways?
What's piezoelectric?
Whoa,
okay.
The piezoelectric?
Yes, I have.
So it's just probably just as impractical, but it's an interesting idea. Oh. So the piezoelectric, Kara, is a property of some crystals whereby if you mechanical forces or mechanical strain is translated into electrical current. So if you squeeze them or pull them, or distort the crystal, it generates a voltage difference across the crystal. And of course, if you then, like, one side becomes positive, one side becomes negative. And if you attach, you know, electrodes to them, if you make a circuit out of it, it'll generate electricity.
Oh my God. How has the Santa Monica woo peddling, like, you know,
yeah, right?
not
Magic
utilized
crystals.
This? Crystal rooms that could power your house. This is crazy.
Yeah. Problem is, it doesn't generate a lot of electricity, right? So generating very small amounts of electricity, but it's basically transferring mechanical force into electrical current. It's pretty cool. The idea is to embed a lot of these crystals into asphalt on roads. And then as cars drive over them, the compression force of the weight of the vehicles will compress these piezoelectric crystals and will harvest the electricity. And
Steve,
can I ask you a question? Is it harder for the cars to drive over that surface, or is it just we're capturing what would have been heat energy from the friction?
So you're anticipating the big question I was going to save to the end. It's true. That's a really good question. And I don't know the answer to that. I could not find the answer to that. But we'll get there back to that in a second. We'll circle back. So the idea is to capture energy that would otherwise be wasted, right? Compressing the asphalt essentially just heats it up. And rather than all of that energy just getting dissipated as vibrations, noise, and heat or whatever, some of it, probably a small amount, but some of that energy will be captured as electrical current from these piezoelectric crystals. So the reason why we're talking about this is because the California Energy Commission granted $2 million to study the feasibility of doing just that, putting piezoelectric crystals into California roads.
Hmm.
So I think, to me, $2 million, meh. I mean, that's a very small investment this on something that probably isn't going to work, but we'll probably learn something, you know, from doing this kind of research. It's not the first body to look into this. There was an Israeli study a few years ago and a project to test the feasibility of piezoelectric crystals in roads, and they abandoned it as not working.
So why are we? Oh, no. Okay.
Well, yeah, whatever. So, yeah, so some people are saying, well, hey, isn't this already been disproven? But, you know, one Israeli project isn't necessarily the final word. Little replications in order. Again, you know, if you look at energy budget or just, you know, all the money that the government's spending, $2 million to look at one, you know, somewhat unlikely but not impossible way of capturing some energy. Yeah, it's probably not the best, you know, use of this money, but I think it's not unreasonable.
But guys, doesn't something tell you here, like, this might be complete bullshit?
Well, of course, yeah.
There are many questions, and you could say, well, this is a research project, so they're trying to answer these questions. Okay. So one of them is what you asked, Jay. So is the energy that would be harvested by these piezoelectric crystals, is that all energy that would otherwise be wasted? Obviously, this isn't a great source of energy. This is just recapturing a little bit of lost energy. You know, if you could think about it as recapturing some of the inefficiency, the energy that's wasted in driving cars, you know. Whenever we run any kind of machine, if you can hear it and if it heats up, that's sound and heat or energy radiating away from the system. That's wasted energy, not doing whatever the engine was designed to do. So some of the energy of cars is not propelling the car forward, but compressing the ground underneath it. So in any case, the question is, when you compress the asphalt, and when I wrote about this, a lot of people asked this very question. It's, okay, when you compress the asphalt, does it bounce back? I mean, it obviously does. Otherwise, it would just get progressively compressed, which it does to some degree, of course. But, you know, there is a little bit of elasticity there. So if the asphalt, when it bounces back, is it giving a little bit of energy back to the car? And if it bounces back less because some of that energy got translated into electricity, will it cost a little bit more gasoline to drive that car?
So interesting.
Yeah. So, and will that offset the electricity that we're harvesting with these piezoelectric crystals? So I thought that was a very interesting question. And it's always good to ask those kind of questions. Is the energy really coming from where we think it's coming from? Or is it adding an inefficiency to the system that will offset whatever electricity we're generating? Whenever you're dealing with really small amounts of electricity, that's a good question to ask. I could not find anyone who did the calculation or whatever to answer that question. My sense is that it's so complicated that they're going to have to just do it empirically, just, you know, just see what if it costs a little bit, tiny little bit more energy to drive over these roads with piezoelectric crystals than without. It's interesting to think about that. But there's also other questions as well. Like, what's the efficiency going to be? I did find some papers looking at that. But again, the answer to how efficient piezoelectric crystals are is it depends on a ton of variables. One paper I found concluded that a maximal efficiency of this theoretical optimal system is about 44%. Of course, you're never going to get to that optimal, you know, theoretical maximum.
What does that mean exactly? Like, if it's 44% efficient.
So 44% of the energy that you put into squeezing the crystal comes out of it as electricity. That's what that means.
And is that regenerative second to second? Or is that something where, like...
Yeah, it's a current. You are generating a current.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's constant.
But if you plug in real world variables, you're down in the 3-5% efficiency range. I suspect, yeah, you're going to get single digit efficiency out of these things. It could be even as low as 1%, who knows, or less. You know, mm-hmm. I think these.
Yeah, but then the cost.
It's very low. Yeah,
yeah.
And then,
are they expensive, the crystals?
Well, there's all different. Quartz is a piezoelectric crystal, right? So it depends on the kind of. There's lots of different crystals that have piezoelectric.
Are the efficient ones expensive?
Yeah, that's one question is how much is it going to cost? What's the energy use to manufacture them, to embed them in the asphalt, to hook them up, to, you know, wire them up or whatever? How are you going to get that current? You got to have wires attached to them.
Yeah, they got to be wired.
Yeah, they got to be wired. And then how long do they last? You know, will they last as long as the road does? And how quickly will their efficiency degrade as the potholes develop and the road degrades? I don't think that roads are a good place to focus our efforts, because roads take a lot of abuse and there's a lot of built-in costs to maintaining them, et cetera. And I just suspect that anytime we try to build in any kind of energy production into roads, the inefficiency costs are going to overwhelm whatever energy we're generating. So, you know, maybe there's going to be some niche applications. Who knows? I think same thing with the solar, you know, pavers. It's the same thing. Maybe there's some niche applications. We're not going to be paving our roads with piezoelectric crystals. You know, that's, I just don't think that's going to happen. You know, unless you could imagine one day where we could mass produce some piezoelectric crystals so cheap that you could actually, it's just as cheap as paving roads, you know, with them as with asphalt or whatever. There's like no reason not to do it. But,
and Steve, wouldn't it be an MFR if like we paved the whole country with these roads and then somebody invents the hover car?
Yeah.
Good news, everyone.
Good news. But the hover cars don't work over roads that have piezoelectric crystals.
Oh, it interferes with the hydraulic converter system.
Right. So anyway, interesting idea. I think it's going to be eminently impractical, but we'll spend $2 million to prove that. It's not going to be practical. That's what I predict. But we'll follow.
Well, California
story.
Will.
You mean
us.
We'll spend $2 million?
Yeah. Kara, that's you, Kara.
Dang it.
All right, Bob. I've heard these crazy claims of unhackable computer code. What's going on here?
Yes. And we're talking about our good friend DARPA. They're doing some way cool shit. Again, this time it's with computer programs. Essentially, they've advanced the state of art of a little known type of software system called formal verification. That can essentially make code bug-free and unhackable. That's the claim. Yes, you heard that right. It sounds fascinating as hell with amazing ramifications. And in my opinion, it's worth, wait for it, billions of dollars of R&D. I really think so. I mean, I've mentioned on the show many times that I'm very concerned about cybersecurity and what people can do from the other side of the planet without leaving their computer. It's kind of scary. So when I first heard of this, though, I thought it was total bull, and I'm sure Jay would agree. Jay and I are in IT. We work with developers. We've written code. We know the software development lifecycle. Zero software bugs is a pipe dream. You can never find them all. You're never going to get rid of all your bugs ever. And so when I heard this, I was like, come on, really? But I mean, we're talking DARPA. So I definitely, suspended my disbelief a little bit and went through the research. So essentially it's these bugs or code errors that make computer systems hackable. That's pretty much the problem. They are what give hackers the ability to exploit your system and lock up your damn computer when you're surfing for porn. The programs that you use every day, though, they're written informally. They're tested to make sure that they mostly work. And, you can't possibly test every possible path of every type of input, which is why wacky stuff happens to you when you're using a program, sometimes. And it's also why sometimes there's security breaches, because they're taking advantage. They're exploiting your system. So, but formal verification, though, creates software that's kind of like a mathematical proof. It's very similar to a mathematical proof. So there's this ineluctable logic as it flows from one statement to the next. Now, there's two major parts to this type of system. You've got the formal specification. Now, that's basically a way of determining and defining exactly what a computer program does. Now, granted, it's for a big systems that would be difficult, but it has been done with small systems. And there's also formal verification, which is the way of showing mathematically beyond any doubt that a program's code exactly achieves the specification that you laid out first. So that's it in a nutshell. I know it's kind of hard to wrap your head around it. I had to read this a few times. So I'll throw you a quote from Brian Parno. He's a researcher. He researches formal verification, and he happens to work for security at Microsoft Research. So he said, you're writing down a mathematical formula that describes the program's behavior and using some sort of proof checker that's going to check the correctness of that statement. So that's basically it. It really is a mathematical proof is a fantastic analogy for this. So now this idea is not new. Actually, it's many, many decades old. I think even Turing flirted with it a bit. I think they quickly realized that it would be just way too much work, a huge effort. And the gains were actually suspect at that time, because the fact was that conventional programming worked well enough. You know, you end up with a program that works most of the time. Bugs were more often than not little more than just an inconvenience. You know, sure, maybe your computer would crash, something would go wrong, start it up again, and you're pretty much okay. But what changed that, guys? What do you think
internet.
Changed that attitude? Yeah, the internet totally changed that. Now computers can be hacked remotely, thousands or more computers at a time. And in addition, and what I'm most afraid of, the risk of hacked, you know, a hacked nuclear facility or other safety critical systems it's reaching scary proportions.
Or your self-driving car.
Well, right, and that just happened. Yeah, and that just happened not too long ago. They showed that they could be hacked. Now, these are the kinds of things that this form of verification can do away with. So clearly, it was time to resurrect the concept of formal verification. But luckily, though, things have changed in the decades since they really were looking at this earlier. The theoretical support is much, much better. The software tools to make it happen are vastly superior to what was available decades ago or even years ago. So the tools and the theory behind all of this have just ramped up so much. And when you combine that with the incredible need for this, it just was this, you know, perfect storm of necessity and ability. So what really convinced me, though, about this, that they were onto something was a test that they did last year. So DARPA invited a red team to hack an unmanned military helicopter that's known as Little Bird. Now, red teams, you may not have heard of those. Red teams are essentially white hat hackers. These are elite hackers that are good guys. You've seen them on TV and movies. I mean, how many? You can't even count. I've seen them quite often. What they do is they hack into a system like real hackers would, for the express purpose, though, of improving the security of the system that they're hacking. Basically, they know what the hell they're doing. They are elite. They're really at the top of their game. And they actually work with the companies that, say, a company would hire the red team. They would work with the security in the company, and they would actually collaborate after the fact. Like, here's what we learned. Here are the problems. So it's that kind of, communication between these two teams are critical to improve the security. These red team hackers, they had their hands on this military drone, and they were given, actually, they were given a gift. They were given access to some of the computer system, which is something that,
hackers wouldn't normally have.
Yeah, absolutely right, Evan. Normally, you don't start off with that. You would have to earn that. They were just given this incredible, thing. And normally, if that happened, normally it would be like these experts hacking your Wi-Fi at home. It would be fairly trivial for them to actually do this. They had their hands on it for 6 weeks, and they could not bust out of that system. They couldn't make any progress. Theoretically, theory would tell you that they failed because it's impossible. And my guess, another way to look at this is that breaching it would be like proving a theorem wrong after it has already been proven right. Let's see, Kathleen Fisher, she's the founding program manager of what's called HACMS, H-A-C-M-S. That's the High Assurance Cyber Military System project. And this is the project that DARPA is working on right now. This is what I'm talking about. She said that that result made all of DARPA stand up and say, oh my goodness, we can actually use this technology in systems we care about. So they really saw that this proof of concept, there really is something there. I mean, when these guys have something for 6 weeks and can make no progress, that was something that really got their attention.
I find that the whole idea interesting, that what makes code hackable is the bugs. You know,
that, yeah.
And that, yeah, that a bug-free program would be inherently unhackable is interesting. I wonder if that's literally true. But
I had the same thought. I hadn't really thought of it in those terms, of that it's really the bugs and it makes sense. But is there any other type of – maybe the way the code is architected and put together, is that – could that make it inherently hackable as well? And even if there's no bugs – but from what they're saying, it's really just the bugs. And so based on what I've read, it's really just the bugs.
Maybe that doesn't exclude like you guys were hinting at the idea of an exploit, and the exploit could have something to do with the way things are communicating with each other as an example, and not so much like, wow, there's an obvious bug in this system, right? So as an example, there's a bug, a lot of it's been cleaned up at this point, but a lot of websites used to have it where you could, in a text field on a website, you could write database code, like you could write SQL code inside of that text field to gain access to the database. So then what programmers realize is they have to like search for certain types of symbols inside the text field and strip them out. So you can't actually get into the database that way. Or now it's a lot more advanced nowadays. But the bottom line is that's really an exploit. That's taking advantage of the system. And you know, you could call it a bug, but it's not really like, oh, I made a mistake. It's more of I didn't harden the system against every single way that someone could get in there and take advantage. So there's a big difference between a bug and an exploit. Yeah. But I'm asking questions about the operating system and things like that, because if this software thing that Bob is talking about is compiled and written in an operating system, and it has to talk to that operating system to do the things that it does, there could be an exploit in between the app and the OS. That doesn't necessarily mean the app is faulty in any way. It just means that, you know, it's not hardened against communication between outside sources and stuff like that. It's super detailed and complicated. So when Bob says all this stuff like unhackable and everything, I don't think you can say that. I think you can say...
Oh, I thought they were building their own OS. They're not?
Yeah, that's like I said,
if they're creating their own platform.
Yeah, if they're going to, one of the goals here is to create a completely verified web server. That's soup to nuts.
And okay, I mean, that makes me feel better.
But Bob, you're right. I mean, they would focus on little pieces of code, kernels that were critical, or that represent
mission critical or safety critical, absolutely,
or security critical. Yeah, Evan, let me ask you a question.
Okay,
what's your sign?
what is my sign currently, or what was it a few days ago? Well, I'm technically a Virgo, I suppose, and I don't think that has changed even with the recent news. And I'm telling you, Steve, this has to go down as one of the worst reported news items of 2016. Yeah. Now, it started with Cosmopolitan magazine, because we all start with Cosmopolitan to get our science-related news.
Ironclad source.
Yes, yes. More specifically, the website Cosmopolitan UK. About 2 weeks ago, when they ran an article titled, "Don't Freak Out, But Your Star Sign Has Probably Changed." Now, I'm going to spare you the ugliness of the whole article by only sharing the first line with you, which encapsulates it nicely. They said, "NASA has decided to ruin our lives by updating the astrological signs for the first time in 2,000 years, meaning that a whopping 86% of us now have a different sign."
There's so much to unpack there.
That was the spark that sort of caught fire on the internet, because soon afterwards, this, and I'm using the air quotes now, news, was parroted and twisted by other media outlets. For example, NBC's popular morning show, The Today Show, in which they said that NASA broke the news that the astrological signs have changed and there is actually a 13th sign of the zodiac. And if you want, you can see an embarrassing video clip online where Matt Lauer and his company do a deep dive into each of their updated zodiac signs. But the best one had to be Yahoo News's coverage, with their headline of the year, which reads, "Your astrological sign just changed thanks to NASA."
Those bastards at NASA.
People Magazine.
It's the first
and National
time in 2,000 years, too.
Oh, gosh. It's all. So as if the headline wasn't bad enough, we know how bad headlines can be. Here's the first few sentences from the Yahoo article. We don't want to be dramatic, but NASA just ruined our lives. For the first time in 3,000 years, they've decided to update the astrological signs. This means that the majority of us are all about to experience a total identity crisis. Apparently, these changes are due to the fact that the constellations are not in the same position in the sky that they once were, and the star signs are about a month off now as a result. To further confuse things, there is now a new 13th sign called Ophiuchus, which those born between November 29th and December 17th are lucky enough to have to learn to pronounce. Oh, gosh. I don't know.
Evan, go Ophiuchus yourself. Okay?
Yeah, exactly.
Couldn't be more wrong. Yeah.
And if you do need a reminder as to how to pronounce it, Ophiuchus rhymes with mucus. So for me, that's kind of what helps me remember that.
I've been saying Ophiuchus.
I used to call it that, but yeah, it's Ophiuchus. And I did check that online, and online never lies, as we know. But thanks to friends such as Phil Plait at the Bad Astronomy blog over at Slate.com, he had a nice answer to Yahoo.
Well, what did he say?
News.
I got to read that.
He said, cripes, no, no, and no. First off, NASA did not update the astrological signs. Second, the constellations haven't changed. And third, Ophiuchus is an ancient constellation identified by the Greeks thousands of years ago. So why is
and
this?
Fourth, astrology is bunk.
Yes, exactly. Why the hell is this even news in the first place? You know, Yahoo News, among others, when they say things like this and they do things like this, they really have a core problem here. They're failing to distinguish that astrology is not astronomy. Astrology is not scientific at all. So when you talk about NASA and the zodiac in the same sentence or the same context, you really have a responsibility to get the context absolutely right. They are polar opposites. And the zodiac is a set of constellations, which are star groupings in the nighttime sky, and we've given them nice names, such as Pisces, Aries, Gemini, Leo, Scorpio, and so forth. And there traditionally have been 12 of these constellations. And these constellations, as observed from Earth during the course of the year, our sun appears to traverse our sky and crosses through these constellations roughly at the pace of a different one each month. And if a constellation is within the sun's path of our sky, that makes it part of the zodiac. Now, people and cultures have observed this for thousands of years, and there is evidence dating back as far as 3,000 years ago to the time of the Babylonian Empire. Babylonians took note of the 12 constellations of the zodiac, and with their 12-month calendar system, it all lined up nicely, and they decided, basically, arbitrarily, to say, we're going to have one sign per month. But in doing so, the Babylonians left one constellation out of the zodiac. Yep, they knew that there were actually 13 constellations which comprised the zodiac, but because 12 worked much nicer in their formulas and with their calendar, the constellation Ophiuchus was left out.
But even that's arbitrary because there are other constellations in the ecliptic.
It's cultural.
Yeah, there's cultural as based. Many as 21 different mm-hmm. constellations that the sun passes through. Some are bigger, some are smaller. It's totally arbitrary to just pick 12 of the big ones and say that's the zodiac.
It's arbitrary.
Or 13,
right.
But there could be more.
And Steve, the constellations themselves are arbitrary.
Yes.
You know, how do you know which stars to group together? I mean, come on, it's arbitrary all the way down.
It's pareidolia. The interesting astronomy here is why the sun is not in the correct constellation as it was, you know, 2,000 to 3,000 years ago, and that's because of the precession of the equinoxes. So the Earth is spinning, right? It's rotating on its axis, and it's like a top, right? You know how if you spin a top, it rotates around as it
right.
spins.
It doesn't stay perfectly up and right, straight up and
unless
down.
Unless you're a
it
really good
has
spinner.
It has a
right,
wobble
so the north,
to it.
The North Star will change over time and moving away from Polaris as it is now to yeah. some other star, yes.
In 13,000 years, actually, Vega will be the closest star to the North Pole. That'll be the North Star,
cool.
Be Vega. Then another, almost 13,000 years, it'll be back to Polaris. So every, like, 25,800 years, the Earth's axis rotates all the way around. And so as it rotates, it shifts where the constellations are with the seasons, right? And so,
that's right.
Yeah, so that's why. It's just the seasons have shifted about 30 days around, you know, the precession, you know, of Earth's axis since they were described 3,000 years ago.
So then why is it that Phil in this article is saying, no, NASA, like the headline of the article is, no, NASA didn't change your astrological sign.
Because this has nothing to do with NASA. This has nothing to do with NASA. NASA
gotcha.
Didn't
so he's
do
not saying
anything.
Yes. But he's not saying your astrological sign didn't change. Again, not that that means anything.
He's just saying NASA didn't do it.
Nature did it.
Yeah, it's just been shifting over the last 3,000 years. It's not.
And NASA pointed our attention to it.
They didn't even do that. They didn't even do that.
They're referencing a blog post that happened earlier in this year, a new graphic basically that NASA put out, mainly for kids and for, you know, teachers who teach the kids this stuff to use in their classrooms. And somebody picked up on that and ran with it in this direction.
Oh, yeah. And didn't this totally already insane. Happen a few months ago?
Yeah, this comes up
this
every day.
This whole conversation? Yeah.
Yeah.
And the fact that there's a 13th constellation among the zodiac that we read, that is so not new. And it's not new. There's nothing new at all to that.
It is hard to pronounce, though.
Forever. And every few years it comes up in conversation and news items and so forth. So when this article says for the first time in 3,000 years they've decided to update the astrological signs, I don't know how much more wrong you can be in a sentence.
Well, it's funny. Phil notes at the end that astrologers wrote an article blaming NASA for all this. And they concluded, here's a deal, NASA. We won't meddle with the next space shuttle mission if you stop giving the world another astrological identity crisis.
Oh my
And Phil's
gosh.
Like, just a note, the space shuttle program ended in 2011.
Oh my God, that is so awesome.
Next stop.
Okay, next. Yeah, let's move on. That's a good place to end that one. All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
Last week, I played this noisy.
You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Oh, yeah.
What was that?
Well,
it's the show intro.
It's the show intro. A thousand years from now, as it decays and morphs over time. Or the signal was sent out into space for many years and then pulled back in on some sort of other frequency, and we pulled it out of that signal.
You are wrong.
It was run through something.
Okay.
Is the show intro having been run through some sort of program?
Well, yeah, yes, but there's a lot more to it. Thank you for trying. that noisy was sent in by a listener named, and my God, am I going to mispronounce this guy's name, is Boss Van Dijk.
That is a great name.
It's awesome.
Boss and Steel. They need to hang out.
God, I hope I pronounced that correctly. He wrote to me and said a lot of awesome things. I can't read everything that he wrote to me because it's huge, but basically he is, this guy has been working in cochlear implant research for the past 16 years, and he is part of a company that's leading.
Jay, will that make you speak in a Cockney accent?
Yes, thank you. He's part of a company that is leading implants for people that have this surgery to add the cochlear implants. So, have you figured it out? That's what our intro would sound like, simulated if you had a cochlear implant.
Oh, cool.
Wait. What does that mean?
So I'll tell you what it means. And these implants are, it's an electronic device, and it's implanted into the cochlea.
Cochlea. It's the cochlea.
Cochlea, where it depends on what part of England you're from, younger.
Or part of the body you're talking about.
So this consists of a bunch of electrodes that are, they electrically stimulate the hearing nerve.
Yeah.
Right?
No, but how, what I don't understand, it's like a transduction. I don't understand how it turns out to sound like this.
Well, all right, because it's a hearing device on the outside of your ear, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then it turns the sound into an electrical signal, and it stimulates the inner ear nerve.
Mm-hmm.
That sends the message to your brain. So it's actually replacing the equipment of your ear.
Yeah.
And it's sending the electrical signal to your brain. And today's implants don't sound as good as a real ear, of course. But over time, the human ear will adjust to it, and it won't sound as metallic and strange as that sounds.
There. Oh, but, so this is actually what I would perceive if I had this implant.
Right. In the beginning. In the beginning, it would sound like that. So listen again. It is interesting now that you know what it is.
You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Your escape to reality.
Now that is really awesome. So Boz knows what it sounds like, and they constantly improve these devices so they represent what is really, you know, a clearer version of what is being heard. You know, I mean, it's a device that's talking to your brain.
Yeah.
That humans made. That's how awesome yep. that is. So thank you so much. The winner this week is Jonathan Barth. And he says, is the sound of this week's Noisy the Skeptic's Guide intro theme as a profoundly deaf person would hear it after processed through a cochlear implant? Yes.
Does he have one?
No, he doesn't.
How does he know that?
Because he read an article in Wired magazine. He told
that is
me.
Amazing.
Yes, very cool, right? So moving along, this week's Noisy, very interesting. Somebody might know what it is. That was definitely sent in by a listener named who may want me to write his name as Alex. So sorry, dude.
What?
I couldn't
whatever
quite
you do,
get it
use
in
my
email.
Real name.
Yeah. So this week, guys, if you have any awesome noises you heard, please send them to me. And if you have a guess, send all that stuff to me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
Okay. Thanks, Jay.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. Are you guys ready for this week?
Sure.
Yes.
All right, three interesting news items. Item number one, a recent study of the cosmic microwave background reveals, for the first time, evidence that the universe has a slight spin. Item number two, the World Health Organization recently declared that measles has been eliminated in the entirety of the Americas. Item number three, a recently published study demonstrates that riding a roller coaster can help remove kidney stones. Evan, go first.
Okay. A recent study of the cosmic microwave background, the CMB, reveals for the first time evidence that the universe has a slight spin. I'm not really surprised at that in a sense. I kind of always envision a spinning sort of visual when I visualize, you know, things about the universe, you know, whether it's galaxies, whether it's clusters, whether it's, you know, lots of things. So if this turns out to be science, I don't think I'll be that surprised. But how do you get that from studying the cosmic microwave background? Why would that reveal a spin? So I'm not really sure why. Number two, the World Health Organization recently declared that measles has been eliminated in the entirety of the Americas. So the North America and South America, huh? I don't know about this one. That's quite a range. You're Canada to Argentina and everywhere in between. That's quite a range of space. I don't know about that one. The third one, a recently published study demonstrates that riding a roller coaster can help remove kidney stones. So I suppose what's happening there is that you ride the roller coaster, you're getting kind of thrown around at speeds that you're not used to. They, break up somehow inside of you and then you pass them?
Yeah.
I think they use ultrasounds and stuff to kind of break up kidney stones or other stones that are in the body. So maybe it's along those same lines that vibration, maybe in the roller coaster, causes those similar vibrations. So I think that one's plausible. So is it the universe has a slight spin, or is it that the measles are gone entirely in the Americas? Oh, gosh. I'm going to say that the universe having a slight spin, I don't think that one's right. I think that one's fiction. And I think that the reason why is that they cannot determine that from just studying the cosmic microwave background. Maybe they looked for it but didn't find it.
Okay, Jay.
All right, you bastard.
Why? Oh. That's to Steve, not Evan.
That was to Steve. No, Evan is not a bastard. Okay, so let me take these in reverse order, if you don't mind, Steve. This recently published study that demonstrates riding a roller coaster can help remove kidney stones. Yes, I agree with this. Roller coasters, especially the good ones, are very, very much vibrating you and shaking you and jostling you around, and that shakes kidney stones loose. Done. The next one. World Health Organization recently declared that measles were eliminated in the entirety of Americas. Now, this one, I could see this one going either way. I didn't hear about like the last case, but I don't think that this is impossible. I mean, we've been heading towards the elimination of these diseases. And if one of them happened to have been recently eliminated, I would say great. Although the anti-vaccine BS, I would think would have slowed this down or stopped it temporarily. But the thing about the first item is that the microwave background radiation revealing that there's evidence that the universe has a slight spin. And a slight spin from what perspective? Spinning to what? In what direction? According to whose perspective outside of our universe? This one can't be anything but utterly and absolutely wrong because there is no perspective outside of our universe. Thank you. I'm done. That's it. This one's a fake one. Anyone that doesn't say that has got parts on order.
Okay, Kara.
Well, okay. The universe has boundaries. So it's expanding it from all directions at all times, but it started somewhere and then it expanded outward. So it would have a spin around that point, right? I disagree with what you're saying, Jay.
All right, we'll talk after the reveal, Kara.
Okay. I do agree that this is the fiction, but I don't agree with that being why. And I do think that if this were fact, like it would be CMB or potentially it could be CMB data that gave us some of that information. But I do agree that it's the fiction. I'm going to agree with both you and Evan. And that's because this is the one that I know the least about in general.
And Bob.
Yeah, surprisingly, I don't have a lot to add. Even the CMB one. But yeah, the roller coaster one. Yeah. I mean, lots of people pissing their pants on the roller coaster. I'm sure that would help things flow in. Not me, of course. But yeah, the G forces, the jostling, especially the wooden roller coasters, man, they just throw you around like a rag.
Oh, the one at Lake Compounds is great. I love it.
Dude, it is. But man, it actually gives me a headache because you're just bouncing around.
What's crazy about that one though is that
it's a wooden coaster. I know you know this because you've been on it. That when it goes over a hump, the cars actually lift off the rails and there's that hook that holds them on. So you can feel like the whole car falling.
So it's
like,
not just me with that sensation of being thrown out of the car. It's sort of happening. Oh, gosh, that's worse.
Yeah, that part I love. It's the back and forth where your head actually hits the damn sides of the seat that annoy the crap out of me. So I'm going to say that one to make sense. That's science, the WHO, measles. Yeah. Yeah, like others have said, I mean, I would think that the anti-vaxxers would have had an effect on this, and it's a little bit surprising that it's completely gone. But I mean, number one, the cosmic background microwave background radiation, that one, yeah, that just, and Jay, I said it surprisingly well. I suspect he may have read the article. Because yeah, from what perspective? I mean, it's like, Kara, it's like velocity. How fast is something going? Well, you have no idea unless you compare the velocity of A to the velocity of B. It's a relative thing. Otherwise, it's meaningless. So,
I would think that if something was spinning, that it would be going either fast. I don't know the basic physics, but I would think that the outsides farther away would be moving more quickly than the insides. Isn't that how spin works? So that's what you would compare
it to. Like a record player.
Yeah, like it's like Doppler shift, but with spin. Like something moving to the left. If you look farther away, it's moving to the left faster.
I think of it as more as a monolithic spinning. Like say you were like inside a ball that was spinning. Unless you had knowledge of what was outside the ball, you would really have no idea that you were spinning.
Well, yeah, but that's not what he said. He said based on evidence in the CMB, not based on like how we feel.
No, but that's just it. The CMB is from within the
really
universe.
Inside the ball, there would be no fluid dynamic measurements that you could take to know that you're spinning.
Yes, there would be, but that's where the analogy fails.
And that's
but
where
still,
for me the CMB is our fluid dynamics. You know what I mean? That you can measure. Anyway, we all agree though that this one's fiction,
right? So I'm going to say that's fiction, and I mean I could be surprised by this, but my gut is to agree with Jay on that, and I would have said pretty much the same exact thing that you know how would you actually determine that from within? So let me say that's fiction.
CMB. All right. I'll take these in reverse order then. A recently published study demonstrates that riding a roller coaster can help remove kidney stones. You all think that crazy one is science, and that one is science.
Yeah, baby.
Somebody noted that should be up for an Ig Nobel Prize for next year. So yeah, they took actually a 3D printed kidney onto a roller coaster and to see if, you know, with little, you know, with fake stones in them, to see if they would, the rate at which they moved through the kidney would change based upon whether or not it was, you know, on the roller coaster. And they found that it did. It actually helped the stones move through the 3D printed kidney.
That's hilarious.
Here's a question.
Interesting.
What was more effective, riding in the front or the back?
Oh,
wow.
Yes.
Both are awesome. Both have different
by far,
heels.
The back is whippier.
The back, you bounce higher in the back.
Yes, the back. The back.
Yeah.
By significant margin.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, but there's nothing like being in front, though, Jay. Being very, very front. Nobody in front of you.
The back is most uncomfortable.
No, I know that. I'm just saying, though, from a jostling perspective, the back is rougher. It's a rougher ride.
It's funny because it sounded like you said from Jocelyn's perspective.
Yeah, I thought the same thing.
Steve, did the stones break up or they just passed?
They just passed through, yeah. So this is based upon anecdotal observations that people pass kidney stones sometimes right after riding the roller coaster. And they said, okay, let's see if there's something actually going on here. So they came up with this, you know, 3D printed kidney model, and they found that, yes, indeed, it does seem to have an effect. Now, this is obviously not the final word on this, but it is one piece of interesting evidence. And the idea is that it is the G-forces that you're pulling as you're whipping around that are really doing it.
Isn't it fun when sometimes the plural of anecdote becomes data?
Well, the anecdotes are not necessarily wrong. They're just unreliable.
Yep.
It can't count it as...
Yeah, you got to follow it up.
The legitimate function of an anecdote is as a guide towards actual rigorous study, you know, clinical research or whatever. Mm-hmm. So you just can't make conclusions. You can make hypotheses based upon anecdotes, but you can't draw conclusions from anecdotes. And that's what they did. That created a hypothesis, and they tested that hypothesis with some empirical data. And so far, there seems to be some support for it. But again, this is going to take more research to really evaluate this. And they said that, but this may lead to treatments, you know, maybe not necessarily going on a roller coaster, but, you know, you could, I don't know, put people in one of those, you know, like the NASA things where they spin you around to see if you could.
Centrifuge?
Yeah, like a human centrifuge. Yeah, there is an advantage to passing stones as soon as you get them because they can get bigger over time. So you would definitely want to pass them while they're small because the bigger they get, the more they're going to hurt when you pass them. And
so, Steve, as a doctor, though, would you agree that if I had kidney stones, I need to go down to like Disney World or Universal Studios to treat myself?
The preliminary evidence would support that, but it's not evidence-based at this point in time, but it's plausible and supported by preliminary evidence. But
Universal, Jay, not Disney for that.
No, Disney. Also, this roller coaster was at Disney.
This roller coaster was, in fact, at Disney, but there's...
They've got... Their roller coasters are kind of lame.
No, because it's the Big Thunder Mountain or whatever, because it's so rickety and like grrr, like it bounces you around a lot.
That's why I thought the vibration had something to do with it.
But. Yeah, but you go on a mega roller coaster, you'll be jostled twice as much.
Yeah, if it's wooden,
but
you don't want to go on a steel, like one that's slick and goes upside down, it won't jostle you around that much, right?
Yeah, big wooden one.
Okay, we're going to jump to number one.
Ooh,
a recent study of the cosmic microwave background reveals for the first time evidence that the universe has a slight spin. Now, before I reveal the answer, I want to correct a lot of the things that you guys said. I'm going to set this up properly, and then the reveal is going to be a little bit more interesting. So one question is, would an examination of the cosmic microwave background reveal whether or not the universe is spinning? And the answer is absolutely yes, it would. If the universe were spinning, there would be like a corkscrew kind of distortion to the cosmic microwave background.
Oh, like it would be compressed in regions.
Yeah, it would have a little bit of a corkscrew to it. But it's also possible that the universe is expanding more in one direction than another direction. And if that were the case, then the cosmic microwave background would not be uniform in every direction. It would be spreading out more in one direction than another.
Right.
So the deeper question is this. Is the universe uniform in every direction? Or is there a directionality to the universe?
Heterogeneous or homogeneous? Yeah.
It's homogeneously heterogeneous.
Yeah. Is the universe directionless? Or is there any objective reference point for a direction in the universe? Obviously, if the universe were spinning, then that would create some objective reference point, and some directions would be different than other directions in the universe. Sure. If the universe were expanding at different rates in different directions, that also would create an asymmetry where one direction would not be the same as any other in the universe. So that's the question. Is the universe absolutely uniform and directionless, or is there anything going on that creates any kind of directionality in the universe? That's what this study was.
But what about the idea that wouldn't the universe have to have an end in order to be spinning?
No.
Yeah, like not Star Trek 5 kind of thing.
I know, it's hard. No. If you can't imagine it, so don't even try. Because there's all kinds of possibilities. The universe could be unbound but finite. And what is it spinning in?
Like the Earth.
Yeah.
Like, what did the study find?
So that's in. Yeah. So I wanted to do that first because. So they studied the cosmic microwave background to look for any evidence of any asymmetry, any corkscrewing that would give any evidence that the universe had a direction to it. And they found. That
none.
That there was absolutely no yes. direction wow. to the yeah. universe. It would have been an amazing bit of news, in fact, if they had found anything
it
otherwise.
It would have been yeah. gigantic.
Because that would have been a huge change in our cosmology. So this supported the existing notion in cosmology that there is no direction in the universe. And so this study of the cosmic microwave background supports that, or confirmed it, if you will, as much as it could. So yeah, but it could. They were looking to see, is there evidence of a spin to the universe? Because who knows? I mean, it could be. There's no reason. They said there are theoretical possible spinning universes. So it's not incompatible with our current physics. So okay. we could have found a spinning universe. There's no reason why we couldn't. It's just that it's not. So our universe does not appear to have any preferred direction or any asymmetry in any direction.
I've always read that it's not spinning. I've always read that. Yeah. So I've got that firmly stuck in my head. So that's why this was so – it just didn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah, that's why you went last.
But it's interesting though, because my gut was that you really wouldn't be able to tell from the inside, but apparently you can. So I was wrong.
Yeah, happens. Yeah.
I still don't believe it.
Okay. All right. That means that the World Health Organization recently declared that measles has been eliminated in the entirety of the Americas, and that is science. So
great.
It's great. It's not as great as it sounds, though.
Yeah.
You have to know the difference between the word eliminated and eradicated.
Yeah, it just means there's none right now.
There's none right now. It's not endemic. What it means is permanent. Eliminated means it's not endemic. That's what it means, which means that it's not being continuously passed around from people inside this area, inside
but
the Americas.
But it still exists.
But it can still be brought in from the outside.
Yeah.
And so what that means is any new case of the measles in the Americas was introduced from somebody outside of the Americas. That's what that means.
Of course.
And then when that happens, you have an outbreak, right? You can have a local outbreak, but it's not endemic. But that's been true for a long time in the U.S.
Yeah, that's the Disneyland outbreak was brought in from outside, right?
So, Steve, that means that you cannot say the following statement. Measles has been eliminated from the planet.
No, because
by definition, that would be eradicated.
Yes.
Yeah.
Steve, is that even possible with a disease like this?
Sure.
To eradicate
it? Who carries measles? Well,
yes, it's possible. So what makes it possible to eradicate a disease? One feature is that it's got to be something that we can prevent sufficiently. So meaning, which practically means it's a vaccine preventable disease. But two, it means there's no non-human reservoir. If there was a reservoir in another animal, then it would be very difficult for us to eradicate it because, we would, even if we eliminated it from the human population, it still would be alive in monkeys or pigs or whatever, and they could be reintroduced back into the human population from them. So
that's why we keep getting Ebola outbreaks. Yes. Like it's always going to happen.
Right.
Ebola probably won't be able to eradicate it because it has non-human hosts. Lyme disease has non-human hosts. But smallpox, no. And measles can be eradicated. Polio can be eradicated.
But to eradicate it, wouldn't you also have to remove it from every lab that might have a sample?
No.
Why? No. You could reintroduce it into the population.
I know, but I'm just saying.
Just like an animal can.
But an animal can and will.
But as a matter of definition, this is just the accepted definition. Mm-hmm. There are smallpox in some lab somewhere.
Yeah.
We still consider it to be eradicated. So if it means the elimination of the wild organism, virus or bacteria in humans with no non-human reservoir. But if we have it locked down in a lab somewhere, we still consider it eradicated. But I guess you're correct in that it could be resurrected, you know, uneradicated or whatever, if it were reintroduced from a lab sample back into the human population. That would be bad.
We wouldn't want that to happen. Biological warfare.
Super eradicated.
Yeah.
Hyper eradicated.
Yeah, but you don't want to get rid of those samples because then if for whatever reason it was
reused, how are you going
to
make
have a sample to help to help cure it.
And at least you know where it came from if that's the case.
That's true.
You have its genetics right then. Yeah, I mean the strains they have in the lab are different. You know, are they? Yeah, they know. Like if you get infected with a vaccine strain, like if you get polio from the vaccine, they will know because it'll be a different strain than the wild type of the polio virus.
Sure.
So it's great. So measles is no longer, and that's because of aggressive vaccine campaigns in South America. Eliminating it from South America as well, and you know making sure it's completely eliminated from North America. It's not endemic, but it can be reintroduced from outside, so there can still be outbreaks. So that's why it's still important to vaccinate. Until it's actually eradicated, we have to continue. We have to keep up the vaccination program.
Yeah, don't stop getting your shots, people. Come on.
Yeah.
Most importantly, I won again. Thank you.
Me too.
Everyone did.
I was happy to blaze the trail for all of you.
Did you guys hear how many websites there are in North Korea?
Yes.
10 or something.
28! 28 websites in the entire country.
.nk.
Most of them are about the leader.
Can you imagine?
You guys saw the Kim Jong-un banned sarcasm. It's punishable by
sarcasm?
Law.
Oh, that's going to work.
Yeah, sarcasm towards him or the regime is punishable by law.
That's a really great idea. All right, well, congratulations, everyone. Good job.
Thank you, Steve.
Hey, Thank you.
Evan, give us a quote.
Cutting off fundamental, curiosity-driven science is like eating the seed corn. We may have a little more to eat next winter, but what will we plant so we and our children will have enough to get through the winters to come? And that was written by Carl Sagan in the book The Demon-Haunted World, Science is a Candle in the Dark.
Thought that sounded familiar.
That is a great, great quote.
Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Thanks,
Steve. Thanks, Doctor.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.